Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Do you eat, sleep, and breathe golf? Do you love to explore? And most importantly, do you just want to have some fun? Well, then welcome to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. Now here's the guy with all the questions, Mitch Lawrence, and the guy with all the answers, Darren Bunch.
Hello and welcome once again to Talking Golf Getaways. Thanks for finding us wherever you consume your podcasts. iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher, of course, as always, on the Golf News Net platform at golfnewsnet.com. I'm Mitch Lawrence in Myrtle Beach. Hey, is Darren Bunch somewhere in the wilds of Bakersfield, home, as you know by now, the Rio Bravo Country Club. You can find us on social media, Darren at Getaways Golf on Twitter or at Golf Getaways on Instagram. You can find me at Mitch Lawrence, L-A-U-R-A-N-C-E, literally everywhere. And Darren, I know that you and I, we're always excited when we have a podcast, we get a chance to talk to, of course, each other. But when we have guests on, like the one we have on today, we've had the pleasure of having Keith Cutton join us on two earlier podcast episodes, and he is back for a very special pod today because of the fantastic book that he has written.
Yes. Were you going to say what the name of that book was right here?
Well, I was going to leave it to you because I figured that would be a good transition. But if you want me to mention the evolution of golf course design, I'll be happy to do it.
Well, it is definitely an evolution, and it's quite a project that Keith has embarked on here. We're going to talk all about it, and who knows where this is going to lead. I may just get out of the way, because I know when you start talking architecture, and certainly when Keith starts talking it, I may not be able to get a word in edgewise. But great to have Keith back on the show, and really looking forward to the conversation today, and helping him sell some books, because you know the holidays are coming up. We specifically timed this to get it out there in early December when people are still making their Christmas decisions here at the last minute. And, you know, hopefully lots of people are picking up this book, because it's one that you definitely want in your library if you are a golf fan, and especially if you're, as we like to call them, a golf architecture geek.
Yes. And we know, as you're going to step out of the way, which I know you won't, that you don't quite fall into the geek category, but you're happy to be on the outside looking in. Before we get started with Keith, we want to, again, thank our great sponsor for today, as we always do, 2under.com, the number 2, and then UNDR.com, great performance underwear. I know Keith is sitting up there in Canada probably going, wait, they're talking underwear before they get to me. But Keith, Darren and I can both just say that this will change your life if you haven't experienced 2Under. Great underwear, great loungewear. Use the promo code and come on. It's, as Darren said, gifting time. GNN20 is the promo code, and you will get 20% off your next purchase.
I have already gifted myself a few 2Unders. Yeah, I've gifted myself a few 2Unders for the holidays, because that's the kind of guy I am. I tend to just buy all my own gifts and then talk other people into saying they gave them to me. That's the kind of way I roll at Christmas. Hey, Mitch, I do want to say one other thing too, since we're talking about golf geekdom. We have a big announcement coming in the Golf News Net family, a new project we're going to be working on. And that's all I'm going to say today on the podcast. But people who are listening are going to be excited about it. It has to do with golf travel, and I think it's going to be a big deal for kind of expanding the platform of Golf News Net, and we'll be announcing that right around the end of the year. So get excited about it, everyone.
Wait a minute. Are you saying you can travel and play golf? Wow. This is a novel idea. I'm looking forward to it. 2019 is going to be great.
Not only saying that, Mitch, but I'm saying we might actually be experts at it.
No way. I'm going to have to start studying. All right, enough of you and me. Let's get to our guest. As we said, Keith Cutton is with us. He is the owner and the driving force behind Cutton Golf, based in Cambridge, Ontario, up in Canada, one of the true rising stars in golf course architecture, I think it'd be fair to say. He has worked to help design or renovate many of the top 100 golf courses in Canada. And though you may not be that aware of Keith when you play golf up in Canada, you should be, because his hands and his dozers and his shapers and his mind and his heart have been all over those golf courses. He's been mentored by some of the most respected people in the game, Bill Kaur, Rod Whitman, Jeff Mingay, Dave Axelin, among others. And the courses that Keith has been involved in should give him instant credibility, if he doesn't have it already, with anyone listening. Both courses at Cabot, the Algonquin Golf Club, Sagebrush, there's so many others. If you go to his great website, cuttongolf.com, you can get an idea of all the places that Keith has been and all the great work he's done. Today, we're going to be focusing not on his courses, per se, but his latest project, as we said, the Evolution of Golf Course Design, which is a stunning gift to all golfers and one that you're going to get to enjoy indoors, unless, of course, you decide to read it outside, which is also a possibility. But this has just been released. It's literally, I won't say hot off the presses, Keith, because it has traveled by plane and now is traveling by boat. We'll talk about that. But the Evolution of Golf Course Design, you can find info on that. And Keith, as I said, cuttongolf.com. You can go to Twitter at cuttongolf, C-U-T-T-E-N golf. Welcome once again to Talking Golf Getaways, Keith. It's taken us a little while to get to you, but please know that we're excited to have you on and to have you take time away from your new duties as head of shipping for Cutton Golf. It's great to have you back with me and Darren.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
That was a long time getting to you, as I said, but we are always excited. I want to really talk about the book. You joined both Darren and I for two episodes, as we said, episodes 89 and 90, for those of you keeping score, of Talking Golf Getaways. We learned a lot about your background, so I'm not going to go as deeply into that here. You did an emergency nine. We know a lot about you, and people who haven't listened to them can go back and listen now. But one thing that I did want to jump into and kind of reiterate about your golf pedigree, because I think this, I thought it then and I still think it when I was looking back over the notes. The fact that your connection to golf and golf course architecture started really early, not just as a case of, yeah, I kind of played golf as a kid, but your family, your grandfather was an avid golfer. He was from England. And your father, you said, this is a quote, he was an environmental scientist by profession and an artist by nature. Mm-hmm. So that kind of combination, if you would just kind of touch on it quickly for those who might not have been aware of it based on the earlier episodes, when did the golf bug really take hold and when the actual connection to architecture kind of kicked in?
No, it's funny. One of the main things about my book is looking at influence, on the major players in the professional golf course architecture. And maybe one of those things that sort of tipped me onto that for the book was having to answer questions like this about my own upbringing and sort of having to process my own influences and background, how I got into this. And you're absolutely correct. My grandfather was an avid golfer, and I'd, watch every time we'd be over at his house and there was a major championship on or just golf, he'd always have it on in the background. And sort of through osmosis, I picked up on his passion for the game. And my father was an environmental scientist with the Ministry of Environment up here for 40 years. He's retired now. But, our weekends were spent hiking and fishing and camping during the summer. And usually at night on TV, there'd be something on the Discovery Channel about animals or, the environment. So it was very much a part of my life. And my dad was also, and still is, a gifted artist, somebody that would pick up a pencil or paintbrush and usually his subject matter was, again, the environment. So these sort of influences were deeply instilled in me early on in life. And it was something that once I had become exposed to golf, I just fell in love with the landscape and the terrain that made the game and the environment itself. And it set in pretty deeply with me when I started seeing different levels of golf courses, particularly Westmount when I was doing my undergrad in university, and just really understood that some of these courses were just a lot better than others, and asking myself why. And that just, you know, started this whole process of diving deeper down this rabbit hole of golf architecture to, I guess, where I am today.
It's interesting you say that. We talk a lot about that. I had a lengthy conversation with a friend last night about, you know, you can go somewhere and have a great golf trip, and the golf courses can be good or even better than good, but it's very rare when you find the golf courses that are exceptional and present a whole golf course experience that is exceptional. And so I think that's an interesting point. As you started your career then, you know, I think in life and in all walks of life, there are two kinds of people. There are people who want to be the guy, and there are people who are happy just working for the guy and helping the guy be successful. And both of those are a good way to do it. I tend to be the latter. I don't always want to be the guy. I like to help other people kind of achieve what they're trying to achieve. And that's why I've been an editor for most of my life. But as you started your career with all these mentors and everything, and you look back on it, I mean, early on, did you dream about wanting to, you know, have your own architecture team and put your name on big projects? And is that part of a trajectory, I guess, that you've worked on these projects along the way for all these other mentors? And, you know, where do you see yourself in, you know, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Do you see yourself being one of those names, or do you see yourself kind of more behind the scenes working with these guys on projects all over the place?
I think it's a little bit of both right now. I think in the future, I do see myself having hopefully a portfolio of work that I've crafted with my name on it that, you know, stands the test of time. That's always, I think, is an artist's hope, is to for their work to sort of last beyond themselves. But I'm fairly lucky right now. I've been blessed with the mentors I've had. You know, you sort of went through the whole list, but I'm still working very closely currently with Rod Whitman and Dave Axelin. We're actually slated next spring to start a short course at Cabot, so I'll be back there again.
Nice.
Doing work, which is incredible. I mean, anytime I can partner with those two gentlemen on a golf project, I'd be foolish to do anything else. You know, they're two of the most gifted and kind men in this business, and talented men. And it's something where I'd be foolish to think I've learned everything I could from them. And I think that's going to make me, you know, I don't know how long their careers are going to last. Look at Pete Dye, he was working into his 90s. So I could be blessed with this sort of partnership for the next 25, 30 years. But and I'm going to exploit that as much as I can. But there'll be a point when that time ends, and obviously I'll be doing things on my own, and I think I'll be better served because of that tutelage, that mentorship.
It kind of makes sense, and like you said, it's such a great combination of things. You have your ideas and what you want to work on, and then you have all these great people that you work with. Let's get back to the book, because it's really why we're here. You got a master's in landscape architecture, among other things, but you have a master's in landscape architecture. A big part of that thesis was the history of course architecture. When I was thinking about this book, The Evolution of Golf Course Design, there are obviously numerous books for years that have been written about golf course architecture. At what point did you decide to jump in and commit to producing a book that covered the subject in a way that I'm pretty sure, hadn't really ever been done before? And that's an amazing statement, given all the books that have been done about architecture. One that deals with design from a really broad perspective. And to me, it incorporates history and culture in a brilliant way. I know people who get their hands on this book are going to feel the same way. At what point did you decide to say, okay, not only do I want to do this because I have these ideas, but I'm going to do it? It's not like you were sitting in a lounge chair somewhere and kicking back. I mean, you have this full life as an architect. At what point did you say, okay, I'm also going to do this?
Well, I think the eureka moment for me, as far as the subject matter happened, I had already done an undergraduate degree at University of Waterloo in planning and environmental design, and I'm a stamp as a professional planner. And the whole master's was sort of this second component of me getting this well-rounded education so that I could bring to my my business, taking projects from start to finish. And as I sat in one of my first Masters of Landscape Architecture classes, it was Landscape Architecture History 101. And what they did, and what I did the same thing in my undergrad, was there was a class that took you, you know, through history and looked at what had happened, but explained why. Looked at history, looked at the influences, economies, what was affecting design. And I went, I've read almost everything there is about golf course architecture. You know, my library is fairly substantial, and I've never seen anybody give this sort of explanation. There's all these sort of little pieces, little dots that you have to connect yourself. And most of it is people looking at what I call architects, and they place them into silos of study, where you look at individual people and their bodies of work. There's very few books that have looked at more of a broader history. There's The Architects of Golf by Cornish and Witten, and there's Golden Age of Golf Course Design by Shackelford. And in the latter, it's really only a specific time frame. And there's still not the historical perspective, the larger lens of view that paints the bigger picture as to why these things were happening, just the facts of what happened. So as I started getting into my thesis, it became clear. One of the first things you do with a thesis is you do a literature review. So you're finding gaps in the literature that your research can then fill. And one thing that's in my book, if people get it, at the back, I've actually I cleaned it up a little bit, but there's a bibliographic essay in the back of the book that basically tells everybody that this, and sort of paints the picture of golf literature throughout time, and shows that this hasn't been done. I really cover almost everything that's been written, including online and print media. So it's something that I had done my research that I knew wasn't there. And when I did the thesis, it just became something that I just kept finding these links and connections, and it painted such an interesting story that it was really when I was done that I went, you know, maybe other people would be interested in this too. So I didn't really go into it with the idea that this is definitely going to be a book, but it's something that was so compelling once I'd finished that, you know, it's my firm belief that if we're trying to grow the game and educate and grow, put a spotlight on my profession, this is the best way to do it, is to sort of make this knowledge known and accessible for people.
Did you ever feel like this was a daunting task to do what you were attempting to do? And after you answer that, I just want to quickly kind of get into the way the book is formatted. But when I saw it, when I got this copy, the digital copy, I'm waiting for my hard copy, because this is all so new. We're literally at the beginning of your process of getting these books into the hands of people. Were you daunted? I mean, did you sit there and go, wow, this is a big get? This is really, I'm getting into something here that's kind of big.
I equate it to, it's funny you mentioned that. I had this discussion with my wife. I almost equate it to a quote from Bill Coore about getting the Sandhill site and him being asked, you know, that must have been so much fun to have that site. And he said, no, it was the most stressful job we've ever had. because it's the perfect site and you don't want to screw it up. And I sort of felt the same way with this book. The pressure was on me that, you know, if I do something like this and I try to tell this history, I better have my facts right, and I better work as hard as I can to make sure that it does paint the full story in an accessible way that people can comprehend and utilize, that sort of hopefully lasts as something that can be utilized by the industry for quite some time. So I did feel that pressure quite substantially, and I think it just made me work harder and continue to fine-tune it. And I know my editor, Paul Daly, I must have driven him nuts by the number of revisions and how meticulous I was with everything. I just had this vision for what this needed to be. And I know Paul is absolutely, he sort of commended me now, and we sort of commended each other for just making sure that all the details were ironed out. And it was something that I even pushed for a peer review process as part of this. This is something that I don't think anybody in the golf literary fray has really done in recent times. It's more of an academic pursuit.
Did you do the peer review before the book was actually published?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was. Wow. So the peer review was basically a fact checking of the profiles in the back that so there's actually a list in the back of the book of who helped peer review certain chapters or certain profiles. And it was just something where I wanted to make sure. I don't consider myself an expert on any particular person. You know, Stanley Thompson or maybe Harry Colt would be the front runners in that category. But there are people out there that, like I said, have done these works that put these people into silos that know their entire professional body of work and understand who they are. They might not understand the external influences and the associations that I brought forward in the book, but there were certain facts that I wanted to make sure I wasn't misconstruing anything. So having this peer review really allowed me to dive a little deeper into the fact that I can stand by the work. And I think it brings another level of credibility to this research that really nobody else, I think, has presented in this industry yet.
Well, that to me, I didn't know that part of it. And I think it says a lot about who you are, too. And that you did this book for the right reason, which is to spread information and do it in a way nobody had done before. And the fact that you went out and had the peer review is pretty amazing to me. This is going to be brief given the scope of what this book touches on, because again, I said before that it kind of blew me away. The whole way the book is put together, it's divided into two sections. The first is the evolution section, evolution of golf course design. It begins with the origins, as everything really does. It goes through every decade from the 1830s through the decade we're now in. It has a little kind of closing section on Ladies of the Links, which I loved, pays tribute to women architects and different women in this part of the game. The second part is comprised of profiles, authors, visionaries, which is pretty amazing too. And it includes pretty much every great name in course design, writing, and how can I put it? The future at every stage of the game, going all the way back. The research in the book, and I haven't come close to finishing reading this book. I told you before we started that I'm taking this slowly because it is so interesting to me that I'm just on the edge of really getting into it. But the research involved had to be off the charts time consuming. You said it took 5 years to put it together. I still can't believe that. It seems in my world like it would have taken longer. How did you manage to do it all while you were having this full bore career as an architect? Where'd you find the time? Did you sleep?
Well, I don't sleep much, but it was something that I did take when I was writing my thesis. I did take a year off from work. And that was something that I just felt that I had to do to commit to this, to that process. And you mentioned the two parts of the book. Really, the chapters that are in there are the profiles that are in there were some of the first things that I did for the research. I wanted to understand who these men and women were and sort of how the profiles different than what you'll read elsewhere is there's more of a focus on their upbringing and how they got into golf architecture and how that then led to the projects that culminated as their portfolio. There's less emphasis on individual projects unless there's something, you know, unless there's a major project that has some sort of meaning bigger in the history of the profession. But what I then did is I sat down and did all these profiles, and that took probably 2 or 3 months of research and editing and everything else. And they were rough at that point. And then what I did is I still laugh about this, and I have it. I created a massive printout of timelines that I created, looking at economies in different countries, courses that were built, when they were built and by whom, allied art forms. So looking at advancements and different eras of design in landscape architecture, engineering, architecture, and art. And also putting, you know, wars and everything plotted out on this huge series of timelines on my wall. And what I would then do is break these individuals up in the profiles into specific time periods. So by decade, what they'd accomplished, and then compare that with each other, and then also with these timelines, which then created the chapters going decade by decade. And if it sounds like it was a lot of work, it was. but it was something that once I did the first 2 or 3 chapters, the connections that I was finding were so interesting and revealing that it wasn't work anymore. It just became, you know, I was a detective finding clues and piecing the puzzles together, something that nobody had really knew. I was sort of, you know, venturing unexplored ground. It was enthralling. I'd spend, you know, literally 16 hours a day in my office just discovering. And I think it now paints that it's all there and spelled out. It paints quite a revealing story of, you know, it answers a lot of questions that people have been asking, even within our industry, for quite some time.
That's an interesting point on the process. You know, I've never written a book, but I've done my share of long form writing projects. And sometimes you go into something like this with the idea of how it will end up, and then somewhere along the way, it takes a dramatic twist on you. Did anything like that happen while you were researching? Was there something unexpected you learned that was kind of particular interest, or even something unexpected that ended up becoming maybe one of your favorite parts of the project?
So one of the big reveals in the book is the association between the arts and crafts movement in Europe, specifically England, in the early 1900s, and how that association actually bred the profession of golf course architecture for the first time. And
wait, could you say that again?
Yeah.
Could you repeat that? Because that's a phrase, that's something I never thought I'd hear.
So it's the association between art and actual golf course architecture. A lot of people were asking for quite some time. The origins of golf architecture in Scotland, as most people know, occurred on Lynx land, which was land that was just naturally perfect for the game. And there wasn't a whole lot of designing going on. People just looked at it, assessed it, and over time, usually the best holes were what became used and formed some sort of routing that you eventually, generally because of St. Andrews, became 18 holes or some version of that. What happened is when the golf boom sort of happened, the emergence of the middle class in England in the early 1900s, because of the Industrial Revolution, there was a want for golf courses, and nobody knew how to design them. So they had professional players that really just wanted to sell their equipment, because back then, to be a professional, you actually made your equipment, feathery golf balls or clubs, and sold those. That was the biggest part of your business. So a lot of them didn't really care what the courses were. They just wanted courses to teach people to then be able to sell their clubs through or their equipment. But what happened is nobody knew how to build them. Nobody knew how to design a golf course or create landscapes that looked like Lynx land. So what ended up happening is the prevailing landscape architecture form of the time was Victorian style, which is very geometric, very uniform and symmetrical and rigid. And what happened is a lot of these early architects employed the same groups of construction workers that were building these beautiful geometric estates for the ultra rich in the country. And the same sort of formulaic principles went into the crafting of these golf courses. And this is what, when a lot of people, if you read The Links by Robert Hunter, a lot of these early golf books, they condemn what they call the dark ages of golf architecture, which is this Victorian style of design. And unless you read my book, you don't really know what they're referring to. You just, oh, there's something bad before, but there's no examples. There's no, because a lot of that was erased later. So there's really no evidence for us now of what that actually looked like. But it was quite startling. Like, there's even pictures of Pinehurst with square greens and geometric hazards that you had to fly, because that early influence went over to America before this arts and crafts influence ended up eradicating it and turning it into something much more natural and strategic based, which it was a sort of parallel thread that then merged. So what happened is a lot of people were asking this question. Golf Club Atlas is probably a website you're aware of, and it's a forum for golf geeks, super golf architecture geeks, and great guys on there doing some incredible research. And there was a man named Thomas McWood that wrote a whole series of what he called Arts and Crafts Golf. And he asked these questions and he made these rough links but couldn't prove anything. And rightly so, people on there dispelled it and sort of put the research down because he hadn't proven anything beyond a shadow of a doubt, which in my opinion you need to do if you're stating facts. What I actually found when I was at University of Guelph and started doing these profiles, and because I looked not just at the architects but at people in media and also developers, members that were influential, what I call visionaries at key projects, I found some of these bigger clues. And the biggest one was Horace Hutchinson, who was the earliest writer on golf architecture, who became the head chief editor at Country Life magazine and really handpicked the architects who were his friends but also aligned with his vision of what golf should be. He took a year off in the late 1800s, 1890s, and actually did a one-year mentorship or protégéship under his mentor, George Frederick Watts, who was a key artist in this whole arts and crafts movement over in England. He actually was a mentor to many of those who are now dubbed arts and crafts pioneers. And because it wasn't, he actually wrote a book, two books, one called Portraits of the 80s, which he actually describes all these influential people in, and another one that he is Cricket, where he actually uses images from his mentor, George Frederick Watts. Unfortunately, nobody looked at these books because they weren't golf architecture, or they weren't even golf. And it was all there. And when you start to paint the pictures, this man was heavily influenced by this artistic movement. And it then completely changed the face of how golf looked, because they started bringing in natural aesthetic to suit the landscape. And they started, another thing about arts and crafts was honoring history in the past. So they started looking at the old course as inspiration. Why are these links courses so good? And they started to distill the architectural elements that made them great and employing that, the strategy of them, into golf architecture. So this sort of aligning of, you know, strategic with this new aesthetic merged in several people, most notably Harry Colt, and was then exported via him and some of his proteges, Alistair McKenzie and Hugh Allison, to Japan, Australia, Canada, and the U.S. And that led, this specific era, all these happenings, led to what we now know because of World War II and just the devastation of Britain. All those people then went to America, and that's what we now know as the golden age of golf architecture. But those origins started in England.
That's fascinating. Talking about the evolution of it, Mitch and I have talked on this show. I had a chance to go to Australia, and I played a place called Ratho Farm. And as you're talking about this, it's the oldest golf course in Australia, and I can envision it as being an example of this process, of this evolution that you're talking about, because part of the golf course is relatively untouched, square greens, very geometric, just like you said. It didn't have all of the holes. You know, it's now an 18-hole golf course, so some of the holes have been done much more recently. They even added a couple just in the past few years to create this. So as you work your way through the golf course, you see those different eras, and it's pretty fascinating. And I never really thought about it until you were talking about it just right there.
Well, I was sitting. I did a presentation at the University of Guelph last week, and it's something I like to do. I've met a lot of good friends of mine through the University of Guelph, especially their turf program. And I was giving us something they do called Turf Club, where they bring people in from the industry, whether it be superintendents or architects or just different researchers, and they give talks on various subjects. And I went in. Obviously, my book just came out, and I was talking about that. And we start getting into Victorian architecture, and a lot of them I can just see weren't really getting what I was saying. And I said, well, how many know Oakmont? And of course, everybody puts up their hands. I said, well, have you ever asked yourself why the greens are square? And they all went, oh. I said, that course is one of the earliest in America, like one of the most legitimate early courses, early 1900s. And that is why that still had that influence, and it hasn't been changed. You know, there's other courses like Pinehurst that had it, but then Donald Ross tinkered with that course for many, many years. And another reveal in the book is he was actually mentored, in a way, at Old Elm in Chicago when he did the construction work for Harry Colt's course there. So this is after he'd been already starting at Pinehurst, and you can see the evolution in his work. So these ideas that were brought from England, emerging in what golf architecture really is, he obviously took that to heart and then became the most prolific designer of the 1920s and 30s.
Well, it's interesting, Mitch. I keep thinking about places we've been just listening to Keith talk, you know, kind of how a place like Digby Pines up in Nova Scotia, that was a Stanley Thompson course, you know, has some of those, it has hints of that, of those geometric shapes and that type of thing, even though the course, you know, and it's largely one of the most untouched Stanley Thompson courses of all time as well. So I think people, after they read the book and certainly after they listen to this, will think differently about how they look at older golf courses, especially when they get out to play them, when they have the opportunity, because there are still hints of that Victorian era out there in various places in the world.
Well, I think that's a great point. And the other thing that I hope this book conveys is the fact that these practitioners of golf architecture, including today, they're all artists. And to expect that their approach to design and their products are the same when they start their career as when they end is just ludicrous, in my opinion. And sadly, that's the way we've treated golf architecture up until about the last 10 years following World War II. It was always looking at somebody's work and either eradicating it and putting your own fingerprints on the design, which was really 50s to the 80s. And a lot of what happened with early restoration is a lot of people looked at, you know, Donald Ross had a certain type of bunker. Sadly, no, he had many different types. If you look at what's at Pinehurst now, and these men were artists and women, and they look at the sites and interpret what their style is going to be based on that. And hopefully that comes out. You know, everything from external influences of design to economy all had to do with what they produced. And if you look at Stanley Thompson, I mean, one of his greatest works, Highlands Links on Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, was done in the Depression. It's a very different, when it opened, it looked very different than his Rocky Mountain courses, which were done in boom years. So understanding that economy of design should help you as a member or a player to understand what you're actually looking at.
And I think, and Darren, I know Darren agrees with this because Highlands is a place that Darren and I could just go and spend the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. Our wives would probably be a little, well, I don't know if they'd be unhappy,
Darren. If we took them with us. And if we weren't there in the discussion. Winter.
But that is such an example of so many different things. And I know you're on the board of the Stanley Thompson Society, so you get it. We certainly get it. And I hope other people use it as an example, too, and they have a chance to go and play it and understand what you're talking about. Before we kind of leave this discussion of the book, I wanted to just touch on the photographs that are in it, because there's so many of them. And there's such fantastic illustrations of what you talk about and the writing. The course photographs go all the way. I mean, there's a ton of historic photographs. They go all the way up to what I love is literally they go up to right now, not 2 years ago, but right now. There's photographs of Mammoth Dunes at Sand Valley. There's the cradle. There's number two at Pinehurst. There's, you know, the things that we're all talking about right now, if you go on social media, you know, those courses are the ones that are in the spotlight right now. How did you put together this incredible compendium of photographs and diagrams about all these golf courses and the history as well? It must have been a really fun project, but it had to have some real challenges, I would think.
Well, we just talked about how long and how in-depth the research was. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little foolishly going into the images, I thought it'd be a lot easier, and it wasn't. It was something that I took the same amount of pride and passion with and really sought images that helped convey the story. So a lot of the times, I hope, is when you read this book, the words sort of are brought to life through these images. And I was, again, quite blessed with some of my contacts in the industry. And I have some of the oldest images in there of St. Andrews and Pinehurst, and you know, I use the Tufts archives and the Stanley Thompson archives at Guelph, and I made a contact with a very nice gentleman, Dale Kincannon, over in the UK, who runs the websites Old Golf Images and GolfImages.com, and he was very generous in working with me to find, you know, images like I have an image of Harry Colt in the book that's never been published. There's just some beautiful images and a lot of plans too. There's over 300 images and plans in the book, and 10% of those, so about 32, 34 images, are plans and graphics and hand drawings by different architects throughout time. And I really think they help tell this story of the different styles and influences of these designers. And you know, the people now, you talk about modern courses, John Cavalier, Evan Schiller, Gary Lisbon, so some of the people with the biggest followings on social media that take just absolutely stunning golf architecture pictures were very, very generous to work with me and allow me to utilize their stunning photos.
I've definitely loved following you on social media and seeing how you've used those photos as well to tell stories about the book, to let people know, you know, give them a sense of what's in it as you've been trying to promote it, you know, over the recent weeks. You know, people probably don't know, and certainly we know this from publishing a magazine for so many years and just the sheer number of words and but most people out there don't know what it takes to get a book written, edited, and published these days. You know, tell us a little bit about that process. Who else helped you get this thing to press and now get it distributed? And more importantly, you know, exactly where can we get it? Because is it just available at cutandgolf.com, or are there other places that people can get it as well?
Yeah. So like many people getting into this, I had no idea what it took to get a book to print. I knew I had a good idea, or at least I thought I did. Luckily I had a very good friend and somebody that would develop into a great friend with Paul Daly, the writer, author, publisher out of Australia. If your listeners don't own his books or series of books, Golf Architecture, A Worldwide Perspective, they're absolutely incredible. He's edited these publications out of individual, multiple articles written by architects and professionals from all over the world. And they're just fascinating reads, little snippets and different articles and in-depth write-ups of courses. So it's they're very interesting. He's written several other books on the, you know, specifically Ben Hogan and this the Sandbelt area of Melbourne where he calls home. And he just, you know, to be honest, he held my hand through this whole process. He put up with my sort of ADD and attention to detail, you know, but well, he put up with my need to just make this thing perfect, but also be jumping around trying to, you know, I need images now, I need this. So it was, I'm sure I wasn't, I don't know if I was the ideal client, but he made it pleasurable. And I think we're both very, very proud of this publication. It's something we've actually put in for a couple different awards, including a printing award over in Australia. So even the quality of the printing and the bounding, you guys will see that when, you know, you get your copies. It's much more exciting to hold it than the digital format. So, but it's something we wanted to make sure that the look of it as well matched the quality of, you know, the effort we put into it on the inside of the pages. And the first, right now, my website is the sole place that people can go, and the sole bookstore, if you want to call it that. The one thing I'm trying to do, I've ordered 7 pallets of the book, or sorry, 8 pallets of the book. One has come, I've paid to have it air freighted from Australia over here to Canada.
I'm sure that's Christmas. Cheap.
It was not, but it was something that, it's funny enough, it cost me as much to have that one pallet air freighted here as it is the other 7.
Right.
But it's something that I've had people following me on this process since I was in school and doing the master's. So it was something that I wanted to make sure people had copies for Christmas. And, you know, Paul's my publisher here, but it's something that I am technically self-publishing now. I've funded the whole thing. I'm marketing the whole thing myself. Thankfully, I'm computer savvy and social media semi-savvy. So, and it's going well right now, but it's something that first palette I wanted to make sure I had. I'm hand signing every copy of that first palette. There's only actually about 50 books left off that palette out of the 375 that are on it. We're on it. So it's selling well. I think people see the value in getting that signed copy. And then when my other 7 palettes show up in January, they're likely going to be on Amazon. Just because the ability myself to keep up with shipping and you know, keeping that many clients, hopefully buyers happy, would be just out of my control, especially when I get back to work.
Yeah, you're going to be building a short course at Cabot. Come
exactly. On. So there's, right. You know, they might be a little angry if I take off every day at noon to ship yeah. books. So
we'll see. I have to go sign my books. Great.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's something that I wanted to make sure that those people that have been following me or assisting me with this process, and there's so many names, a lot of them are actually either thanked in the book or given credit. I just wanted to make sure that that was there before Christmas, and either my gift to them as a thank you or something that they could purchase the book themselves and have that, you know, that first limited series hand signed. So. There'll still be an option for hand sign in the future. I'll probably hold on to a handful of books, but that'll be based on my ability to get home and sign them and ship them. But I think Amazon's going to be in future will be the main spot for distribution. But right now, that's the spot everybody can go is cuttinggolf.com.
Well, I love the fact, and it says in the same way, what's inside the book says a lot about who you are. I love the fact that you wanted to get those people signed copies by Christmas, and that also obviously says a lot about who you are too, Keith. The reviews that I've seen have been fantastic. You've gotten kudos from Bill Kaur, Ron Witten from Golf Digest, big name, obviously Adam Lawrence, who's the editor of Golf Course Architecture magazine, and one of Darren and my faves, who we've had on Talking Golf Getaways, Zach Blair, player on the PGA Tour, but somebody who's really interested in architecture. He raved about it as well. And of course, Darren and I, which as far as we're concerned, they're the two biggest reviews you've gotten. I can only say that this, I'm sitting in my office looking at quite a large number of golf books here. But I can't wait to have the hard copy of Evolution of Golf Course Design. And it's going to be front and center for a long time. And we can't thank you enough for writing it. You're adding to what a lot of golfers love about the game. All I can say is thanks. We appreciate you.
Well, thanks, guys. That means a lot.
I want to say that Keith also obviously said that you can go and go to cuttinggolf.com, C-U-T-T-E-N, for your copy of the book. And again, you can interact on Twitter. And if you're not following Keith on Twitter, at cuttinggolf, you're missing out, because as Darren said, this is really a great way of learning about the book, and the little snippets that you put up every day, if they don't make people want to run out and really run and order this book, then there's something wrong. Great time, Christmas coming up, and even after that, anybody that loves the game, you, your friends, just go out and get it. Thanks for all you've done for us on the playing grounds, Keith, and again with the book. Darren, any parting words for Keith?
We will see Keith down the road. We're already talking about trying to play some golf with him in 2019.
There you go.
To the listeners, obviously, well, we couldn't do it without you. Follow us on the social media, rate us on iTunes, help us spread the word about the best in golf travel, and help us spread the word about the best in Keith's book.
Yeah, there you go. Keith had a dream, the evolution of golf course design. It is now a reality. Thanks for being with us, Keith, and all of you. Darren, I'll talk to you soon. The rest of you, go run down your dream. So long.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.